This is the Sunday Catholic Word, a production of Catholic Answers, the only podcast to look at the Sunday Mass readings from an apologetics perspective.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Sunday Catholic Word, a podcast where we reflect on the upcoming Sunday Mass readings and pick out the details that are relevant for explaining and defending our Catholic faith. I'm Carlo Broussard, staff apologist and speaker for Catholic Answers, and the host for this podcast. In this episode, we're going to focus on four details that are relevant to apologetical discussions. Two of the four come from the first reading, which is taken from Exodus chapter 22, verses 20 through 26, and each deal with separate questions: whether God is a moral monster for killing people, and whether charging interest on a loan is sinful. The other detail comes from the gospel reading, which for this 30th Sunday of Ordinary Time, year A, is Matthew chapter 22, verses 34 through 40. And this detail relates to two apologetical topics: the necessity for Christians to keep the Ten Commandments and the doctrine of purgatory. So let's start with the first reading, again taken from Exodus chapter 22, verses 20 through 26. Here's what we read. "Whoever sacrifices to any god save to the Lord only shall be utterly destroyed. You shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall not afflict any widow or orphan. If you do afflict them and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will burn, and I will kill you with the sword. And your wives shall become widows and your children fatherless. If you lend money to any of my people with you who is poor, you shall not be to him as a creditor, and you shall not exact interest from him. If ever you take your neighbor's garment in pledge, you shall restore it to him before the sun goes down. For that is his only covering, it is his mantle for his body, and what else shall he sleep? And if he cries to me, I will hear, for I am compassionate." Now, as I've already mentioned, there are two details here that we're going to briefly touch on. The first is God's warning that he will kill the one who afflicts any widow or orphan. Again, here's what we read. "If you do afflict them, widow or orphan, and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will burn, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall become widows and your children fatherless." Now, a question that could arise here is, doesn't this make God a moral monster? To begin responding to this question, we have to first ask, why would God be a moral monster for doing this? Now, I can only think of two possible reasons. Either A, because the idea of an all-good God is mutually exclusive from the act of killing someone, regardless of the reason, such that there's no possible way to affirm both ideas at the same time. If we affirm the existence of an all-good God, well, then we can't at the same time say that he kills people. So killing people is intrinsically evil, which an all-good God could not possibly do, because God can't do evil. Or B, if we accept that God can kill at least as a form of punishment, but perhaps God's killing here is disproportionate to the crime. Now, concerning the first possible reason, this doesn't hold. The only way that God would be doing an injustice to the human being by directly willing his death is if God owed the human being behavior that doesn't involve killing him. But this is not something that God owes us. If God didn't owe us the coming to be of our corporeal nature, then God doesn't owe us the sustaining of our corporeal existence. God didn't owe us the coming to be of our corporeal being because God is not bound to create in any way whatsoever. Our existence as a corporeal being is pure gift. It follows, therefore, that God doesn't owe us the sustaining of our corporeal existence either. This being the case, it's not an injustice for God to permit the ending of our corporeal existence or to even directly will its cessation. Now, someone might counter, well, there are some things that God can't do in relation to us. For example, he can't command us to perform deviant sexual acts like sodomy, because he would be going against himself and violating the very design that he has designed our sexuality with. So too, God can't kill because he would be violating the very nature of a human being. So again, this is a possible objection to show that killing a human being is intrinsically evil, even for God to perform. This is something God would not be able to perform. Well, he wouldn't be violating the nature of a human being by directly willing his death, because death is part and parcel of the nature of a corporeal being, which a human being is a particular kind. Consequently, God would be willing something that's consistent with the nature of the human being, not a violation of it. Again, death is part and parcel of our corporeal existence insofar as we're corporeal beings. Now, somebody might respond and say, but the timing of a person's death is something that's not natural. It's brought to an end in this case in an unnatural way. Well, actually, it's not brought to an end in an unnatural way. Rather, the life's natural end is brought about in a way that's over and above nature. In other words, the natural end is brought about miraculously. Concerning the timing of the natural end, there's nothing that belongs to the nature of a human being that specifies a particular timing of a human's death. So God wouldn't be violating human nature and the principles of human nature that he brought into existence by directly bringing it to an end, at least a corporeal existence to an end. Nor would God be violating human nature as to the means of death, because as I've already mentioned, God doesn't owe the sustaining of our corporeal existence. So in sum, God does no injustice by directly willing the natural end of a human's death at a particular time, even if the reason for willing the death is not for punishment. In this case, in the case of the first reading, it's for punishment. But even punishment aside, I think we can reason to show that there's no injustice for God even to will natural death for an individual, directly will the cessation of corporeal existence for an individual. Therefore, he's not a moral monster on this front. There is no injustice, as Aquinas says. The Creator giveth and the Creator taketh. He giveth life, he can taketh life. And there's, at least intellectually, there's no injustice. Now, is there an emotional problem here? Yeah, because it conflicts with our modern sensibilities, because we only operate based on how we relate to other human beings, which we cannot take the life of when they are innocent. And so we have a hard time, let me say it like this, we often project onto God our own human experiences and relationships with other human beings. And it is very difficult to us that whenever we think of God to take out, when we apply certain things to God, the creaturely limitations of those things, right? And so even though it is wrong for us to take the life of an innocent human being, that duty and obligation does not apply to God, who does not have an equal relationship to other human beings like I have to other human beings. And that's hard for us as human beings to swallow emotionally. We can see it intellectually, but indeed it is a hard emotional pill to swallow, and I'll concede that. But intellectually, there's no injustice here. Now, what about the second possible reason as to why God is a moral monster? Maybe there's a disproportion between the punishment, death, and the crime afflicting the widow and the orphan. But I don't think this works, because preying upon the most vulnerable is deserving of the harshest of punishments. So the crime ranks up there pretty darn high in the hierarchy of gravity concerning criminal activity or sinful activity. And of course, that would be of equal value to the harshest of punishments, namely death itself. So this gets to the principle of proportionality with regard to the crime and the punishment for the crime. At least from God's perspective, he's revealing to us that he ranks the affliction of widows and orphans as of the gravest of kinds, right? And so thereby meriting the gravest of punishments, in this case, death. Okay, so that completes our reflection for the first detail. The second detail that's worth highlighting in this first reading is verse 25. If you lend money to any of my people with you who is poor, you shall not be to him as a creditor, and you shall not exact interest from him. Now, this opens up a can of worms, man. This brings up the topic of usury and its sinful character as declared by the church and known by reason, which St. Thomas Aquinas articulates in Summa Theologiae, second part of the second part, question 78, article 1. You can check that out. The question that often comes up, however, is whether the church changed her stance on usury in modern times. Unfortunately, this is too big of a topic for us to get into here in this episode, but suffice to say that verse 25 here doesn't forbid the taking of interest on a loan in an absolute sense. Rather, it only forbids taking interest on a loan that's given to a poor person. So someone could legitimately ask, based on this text, well, what about taking interest on a loan for someone who is not poor? This is a question, of course, that's much debated. Now, it is interesting. Deuteronomy 23, 19 through 21 permits charging interest for a foreigner, where it says you may charge interest to a foreigner, which would seem to indicate that charging interest on a loan is not in principle in all circumstances intrinsically evil. So, but nevertheless, the church has been clear in its teaching throughout the centuries that usury, quote unquote, is a sin. There are too many pronouncements to list here, but consider, for example, Canon 29 of the Council of Vienne, which is the 15th Ecumenical Council in 1311. It states this: if indeed someone has fallen into the error of presuming to affirm pertinaciously that the practice of usury is not sinful, we decree that he is to be punished as a heretic. So the positive statement is, it's a part of divine revelation here that usury is sinful. But there are two questions that become very pertinent to this discussion, and all I'm intending to do here is establish the parameters for the discussion. What does the church mean by usury? And are there modern-day examples where an interest on a loan does not count as usury, as condemned by the church? As I said, this is too big of a discussion to have here, but there are a few resources at Catholic.com that you might want to check out, at least to begin the dialogue, the conversation, the research. There's an article entitled The Red Herring of Usury, written by David J. Palm. Another article entitled Did the Church Change Its Stance on Usury, by Christopher Kaiser. And then we have a couple of Catholic Encyclopedia articles at Catholic.com. One is just quote-unquote usury, and the other title of the Catholic Encyclopedia entry is interest parens monetary. So that would be in quotes there. So those are a few resources that you can refer to, at least to begin the research on this thorny issue. But I think those two questions I articulated are key for establishing parameters and guidance for the research. What does the church mean by usury? And are there modern-day examples where an interest on a loan doesn't count as usury as condemned by the church? Okay, so now let's turn. I'm going to put that topic off to a side, and I'm going to be frank here. I'm punting on that issue because it's just too deep to go into here, and it's very complicated. Let's now turn to the gospel reading for this upcoming 30th Sunday of Ordinary Time, Year A. Recall the gospel, again, is taken from Matthew 22, 34 through 40. Here's what we read. When the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together, and one of them, a scholar of the law, tested him by asking, "Teacher, which commandment in the law is the greatest?" He said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the greatest and the first commandment. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. The whole law and the prophets depend on these two commandments." Now, there are two details that I'd like to focus on here. The first is Jesus' teaching that love of God and love of neighbor sums up the law. The significance this has is that the Ten Commandments are still binding on us as Christians, contrary to what some Christians might say out of fear of being charged of professing a works-based righteousness. We are not freed from the obligation of keeping the Ten Commandments, and precisely because we are not freed from the obligation to love. Jesus reveals in this passage that the Ten Commandments are nothing more than an expression of love, which, of course, basically sums up the natural moral law. The first three express love of God. That's something that we can come to reason come to know by reason alone that there is a creator and we must love him and worship him. The remaining seven express love of neighbor. Again, things that we can come to know by reason alone, based upon the order of good inscribed within our nature called the natural moral law. And given that love is something we're all bound to do, or bound to, not only as Christians, but also as human beings and the natural love of loving fellow human beings, it follows that we're bound to keep the Ten Commandments. So the Ten Commandments are obligatory based on the natural moral law. It's human nature, which has its author in the Creator himself, and its binding authority in the Creator himself, that obliges us to keep the Ten Commandments. So the Ten Commandments basically the instruction manual for the art of human living so that we can live our human life well. That's basically what the Ten Commandments are. Because that's what morality is about living well in accordance with the design that God has inscribed within our nature. And to act contrary to that design is to act contrary to God's will, which is the essence of sin. Now, the second detail that I think relates to apologetics is Jesus is teaching that we must love God with all our heart. Consider a Christian who dies in friendship with Jesus, yet has a remaining unhealthy attachment to a creaturely good, which often happens as a consequence of sin. Now, the unhealthy attachment is not meritorious of hell because the creaturely good hasn't necessarily taken the place of God. The Christian still loves God. But due to the unhealthy attachment, he doesn't love God with all his heart. If a Christian dies in this state, we could ask the question, is heaven guaranteed to him? Yeah, because he died loving God, but he died imperfectly. The creaturely good that he has an unhealthy attachment to hasn't taken the place of God, right? So he still loves God. But can he immediately, so he's not going to go to heaven because he's still loving God, but can he immediately go to heaven? No, because loving God with all your heart is required for immediate entrance into heaven, or entrance into heaven, period. Remember our Lord says in Matthew 5:48, be ye perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. So this Christian who dies loving God is guaranteed heaven because he dies loving God, but he can't immediately enter heaven because he's not loving God with all his heart due to the unhealthy creaturely attachment. Therefore, between death and glory, that lack of love with the entirety of his heart must be made up for. So how is the heart going to be brought to where it needs to be? Well, the Catholic answer is by the purging of the unhealthy attachment, which takes place in this final purification after death that we call purgatory. And once that's done, then the Christian can love God with his entire heart, with all his heart, thus fulfilling the command of Jesus, and thereby enter into the beatific vision. So Jesus' teaching for us to love God with all our heart relates here to the doctrine of purgatory. It gives us yet another way by which we can argue for purgatory from the Bible. It doesn't explicitly reveal purgatory, but it provides for us principles upon which we can build a case for purgatory, which I do in other ways in my book, Purgatory is for Real, The Good News About the Afterlife for Those Who Aren't Perfect Yet, which you can get at shop.catholic.com. And yes, that was a plug. That was a sales pitch. I need to put bread on the table for my wife and kids. Please help. All right, my friends, that does it for this episode of the Sunday Catholic Word. The first reading in the gospel for this upcoming 30th Sunday of Ordinary Time, year A, gives us some opportunity to reflect on a few apologetical topics here. The goodness of God, usury, the necessity to keep the Ten Commandments, and of course, the doctrine of purgatory. As always, I want to thank you all for subscribing to the podcast. Please be sure to tell your friends about it and invite them to subscribe as well. And you can do so at SundayCatholicWord.com. Check out our other great podcasts and our Catholic Answers Podcast Network. Cy Kellett's Catholic Answers Focus, Trent Horn's The Council of Trent, Joe Heschmeyer's Shameless Popery, and Jimmy Akin's A Daily Defense, all of which can be found at Catholic.com. One last thing, don't forget to check out the cool mugs and stickers with my logo on it, Mr. Sunday Podcast. You can go to shop.catholic.com for those goodies. And my friends, I hope you have a blessed 30th Sunday of Ordinary Time. Please lift us up in your prayers at Mass, myself, my family, and the family here at Catholic Answers. We need all the prayers that we can get. Until next time, my friends, God bless you all. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Sunday Catholic Word. Find more great shows by visiting CatholicAnswersPodcasts.com or just search for Catholic Answers wherever you listen to podcasts.